Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Rural Routes to Change discussion brought to you by Praxis International and the Office on the Violence Against Women. I'm Liz Carlson. I am calling from the Duluth Praxis office in Minnesota, and so glad that you all could join us today. Our discussion today should be a fascinating topic and fascinating information that pertains to the impact of advocate-initiated response following law enforcement intervention. We have three guests joining us on the line, and Rose Thielen, who is our regular CCR coordinator on these calls, facilitator. And so I'm going to turn the call over to Rose to introduce our guests in just a moment. Before I do so, I just want to give you a couple of quick pointers about how this call will function. So the participant lines are muted, but that in no way should dissuade you from joining the conversation. It will just require that in order for you to be able to ask a question or make a comment during the session at any time, you would press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. That will get you into the operator queue, and after a moment or two, we will open your line, unmute your line specifically, and then you'll be able to interact with our guests today. So know that that is a possibility for you at any time. If you prefer to email a question or a comment to me, you can do so as well. Send your email to liz@praxisinternational.org, and that email address stands for any sort of technology issues that you might be experiencing. Feel free to email me at any time. And then I just wanted to let you all know that this call is being recorded. So if there perhaps are your coworkers or colleagues who are not able to participate today and they would like to refer to the recording after the fact, it will be available on the Rural Audio Archive recording page of the Praxis website, and so you should look for it there after a week's time. So that's all I have for now. Rose, welcome to you and to our guests, and why don't you go ahead and get us started if you would.
Thank you, Liz. It's a pleasure today to have a few women from Denver on the line who participated and were the authors of important research. And it's the research is called The Impact of Community-Based Outreach on Psychological Distress and Victim Safety in Women Exposed to Intimate Partner Abuse. And then there's a second piece of research called The Impact of Victim-Focused Outreach on criminal legal system outcomes following police-reported intimate partner abuse. The research always seems to have the longest titles, but it's a great pleasure to be on the line with Margaret Abrams, who is from the Denver District Attorney's Office, Dora Lee Larson from the Denver Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, and Anne DePrince, who is the lead author on the research. And they're going to discuss their important work and its implications. We'll talk about today the research, about how it was done, what you found out, and what are the implications of the study. But let's start by, first of all, welcoming you all. And Dora Lee, can you start by describing what you mean by community-based outreach, or as we sometimes describe it, advocacy-initiated response, and then also what you were comparing it to?
Absolutely, Rose. I also want to take this opportunity to thank Praxis for the opportunity to share our experiences and information from Denver. I think a lot of what we're doing here through the Triage Project can be replicated pretty much anywhere, whether you're from a rural program or an urban program or a combination of the two. So thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to give you just about a two-minute history, or herstory, as it were, of Denver's work in regarding domestic violence victims and response. Denver's been a leader in domestic violence response for probably 3 decades. We have developed and instituted very effective policies and processes in responding to domestic violence crimes, and our commitment to the CCR, to the Coordinated Collaborative Approach, stems from, as most listeners know, the very complex nature of domestic violence and the unique challenges in finding the most effective long-term intervention. So, again, as listeners know, there's very few other crimes that involve an ongoing relationship between the offender and the victim, where there's been repeated assaults and threats, and where they have children maybe, or they may have a home or property or other financial assets and liabilities. And the victim is often forced to continue communication with the batterer and consult with him, generally speaking, regarding these and other issues. And even on those situations or in those situations where she may be able to escape the relationship, she is often still forced to maintain an ongoing contact or relationship with the offender and may experience some degree of economic dependence on him, especially if he is the father of the children. And, you know, as everybody knows, effects of the abuse may leave her homeless or jobless or acute or chronic health problems. She may be depressed. She may be anxious and struggling to effectively parent children. And, again, I'm preaching to the choir. I know that, but I think it's really important to give just a little bit of a background. So in 84, Denver was one of a handful of communities, progressive communities nationwide, to start the interdisciplinary program, which included the probable cause mandatory arrest policy. It all started in Denver due to the threat of a lawsuit here by battered women's organizations. And crucial to Denver's success in developing the progressive and comprehensive policies, there came a history, or herstory as it were, of close collaboration between the criminal civil legal systems and the community-based services. The Domestic Violence Coordinating Council was also established in 84, and we are one of the longest-running councils nationally. And we provide a forum for the criminal and civil legal system personnel, along with community-based organizations, to continue to enhance the coordination of services and policy development. This is an ongoing process. It certainly doesn't happen in a vacuum. And tweaks and changes and work has to happen almost on a daily basis. So the history and ongoing success of Denver's domestic violence community in actively addressing victims' needs has provided a strong foundation on which to advance the groundbreaking work, which brings us here today, done by the triage review team.
Darlene, let me ask you a question here.
Am I talking too fast?
You're talking very fast, but I was able to get in there.
Good.
Yeah, but you know, and just not to take you off track too much, but when you talk about your coordinated community response, are you speaking specifically about criminal justice and advocacy program representatives,
yes,
or is it a whole?
I was going to get to that in a few seconds as far as what comprises our CCR. But specific to triage, current success is providing training to law enforcement, prosecutors, whoever will listen, even sometimes judges, which we're going to be doing in about 2 weeks, expanding and redefining outreach and follow-up of victims, and actually even doing home visits, which will be explained by the triage detective and victim assistance team. And in certain cases, one of the things I also wanted to stress is that anybody at the triage table can request a home visit that's not just dependent on the system or criminal legal system request. So in certain cases, victims may be given a stalking kit equipped with items to help them take better safety measures. There's also hope phones available, and there's a variety of community-based services devoted to domestic violence victims, including shelter, counseling services to children, women with disabilities, a program with expertise on same-sex violence and other programs, and additional advocacy services provided by system-based advocates. Denver is one of the few cities that actually has a dedicated protection orders court, and which started in 1993, and one of the agencies in triage, Project Safeguard, provides daily advocacy and assistance to battered women filing petitions for civil protection orders.
So the Denver triage review team, then, that's the group that looks at post law enforcement intervention.
Absolutely. We actually have access to virtually every police report that comes through the Denver Police Department regarding domestic violence incident. We usually have that information, I would say, on the average of about 12 hours after the incident. Sometimes it's a little bit longer than that, but I think that's a general average.
Okay. All right. And then you contact the victim, right?
Depending on what the victim needs. The first point of contact is through the advocates in the Denver Police Department and sometimes with the advocates in the Denver City Attorney's Office. At that point in time, the advocate will let them know that we are at the community-based organizations are at the triage table, and they will say, it sounds to me like you might benefit from information from Safe House Denver or information from the Dumb Friends League. So the coordinating council would step in and be that liaison. Or they may want information about Safe House Denver for counseling for their kids, or maybe one of the programs that actually isn't sitting at the triage table, but we can be a liaison to that. So we really have access to pretty much whatever a victim might desire to help them in their situation.
Oh, very good. Okay, so that and that's what you were what you were evaluating through the study, right?
The what Dr. DePrince's research is showing, it was doing, was basically evaluating the victim's perception on how that how well that was working for them. But I'm certainly going to let her address that.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Sure.
So
the other thing I think that's important, too, again, is that liaison piece that the Coordinating Council does provide, because we have four community-based organizations that are involved in the triage project, and then three or four different criminal legal system folks. But if you had any more than that at the triage table on a daily basis, you couldn't get anything done. So it's really important to have that relationship and that liaison ability. For example, there may be a victim of domestic violence where the criminal case happens in Denver, but they live in Aurora, which is in a different jurisdiction. I have a really good working relationship with the Better Women's Program in Arapahoe County. I have a good working relationship with the Better Women's Program in Jefferson County. So that liaison piece is really important, because we couldn't have 55 different agencies at the table, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But that relationship and that liaison is really important to develop and to maintain.
Right, right. And so you were looking at, you know, what's the value of this to victims, huh?
Exactly, exactly. And again, it's so victim-oriented. It really is totally, if they don't want any contact by any of the agencies, we don't do it. The only exception in that scenario is, let's say the victim assistance folks can't get a hold of the victim. Let's say she doesn't necessarily want to talk to somebody from the system. Anybody at the table can then request one of the community-based organizations to do a cold call. And that's taken a little while for people to get comfortable with. But I think at this point in time, and Margaret can testify to this, that more and more of the community-based organizations are totally comfortable with calling someone and say, I got your name through the triage project, and we're hoping that we can help you and give you some assistance or whatever. Because a lot of times victims, believe it or not, may not trust criminal legal system involvement. They would feel more comfortable talking to somebody from Safe House Denver or Project Safeguard or something like that.
Right.
And this is Margaret. I'll jump in for just a minute. I think that is the biggest shift that occurred with the triage team, was really having both community-based and criminal justice system folks collaborating on how do we do outreach better? How do we make sure we're being a little more proactive, rather than, I think, you know, criminal justice system folks, advocates are very used to calling victims, giving them information, telling them kind of what the status of things are, and community-based agencies are very used to hearing from victims and working long-term with them and providing the advocacy, and it's different for them to initiate that outreach. So it really was a shift on both parts in terms of the criminal justice system folks getting used to asking victims more questions and looking at the bigger picture of risk factors and thinking about, are there community partners that can really assist this victim with the bigger needs rather than just whatever's going on with the criminal case. And likewise, community partners really looking at what is it that's going on with the criminal case that may impact this victim's ability and comfort with seeking out services. And it just so happened that we were putting together this idea, which, of course, as service providers, we all thought made perfect sense and was a really cool idea, but really didn't know from a research perspective, does this really make a difference in terms of how victims, what their well-being is long-term, what their willingness is to participate in the criminal justice process? Does it make sense to be shifting how we're doing outreach, which is where it was great to be able to partner with Anne to really be able to take a step back and really take a more critical look at, does this work? Does this make a difference?
Very good. So, and that's a good segue into talking about it, huh? What was the research and the methods and what you come up with. So, Anne, do you want to take us into that?
I'd love to. And let me echo Doralee and Doralee's gratitude for this opportunity. Thanks so much for the chance to talk with folks. In terms of the overall goal of the research, we had a broad goal to evaluate the impact of Denver's Community Coordinated Response, their CCR program for victims following reports of intimate partner abuse, which I'll occasionally lapse into referring to as IPA, to law enforcement. And we went into the project understanding from our partners that that triage involved this interdisciplinary review team, including members from the criminal justice side, the city and district attorney's offices, the police department, and I'll refer to those folks throughout describing the research as the system-based players. And then we also knew that the interdisciplinary team involved community-based partners as well, including Doralee's Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, as well as Safe House Denver, Project Safeguard, and some other agencies in town. And our goal was to use the gold standard for intervention research, an experimental design where we were able to randomize, in this case we focused on female victims of IPA, to receive either the CCR, community-based outreach, or treatment as usual in the system at the time, which involved somebody from usually the system-based side providing referrals to women, which might be a suggestion, you know, you could contact Safe House Denver if you were looking for counseling services. So that was our overall goal, to evaluate this kind of CCR. What I'll do in a moment is walk you through exactly how we went about this and what we found along the way. I'd encourage folks, if you have questions, to let me know, and certainly Rose has promised to interject questions and comments along the way so that I don't just talk at you for a whole bunch of time now.
Right, and so if you want to, if there's any questions thus far, hit one and you'll get into the queue, so that's a good reminder.
Actually, this is Liz. There was one question that was emailed into me, so if I can interject it right now, Anne and Rose.
Yeah.
This caller is wondering if you have noted in your research that survivors are leery talking to advocates because of the perception of the connection between the advocacy program and the criminal legal system. That's impacting that relationship.
Gosh, the answer is probably kind of somewhat complicated. I think I'll just answer that quickly with more anecdotal than percentages to cite to you right now. We did find throughout the study that women had a difficult time knowing necessarily whether the people they were talking to were system-based or community-based advocates. So we might say, for example, did you talk to someone from Safe House Denver? And women didn't always know whether they had or not. And this became an issue to the point that we went back to the triage folks and said, could you give us names of people who work at these agencies? Because then I can say, did you talk to Melissa or whoever? And so to some extent, we did hear from women concerned about sharing information because they didn't always know whether that person was in the system or outside of the system. But that certainly wasn't for all women. And in fact, I'll share with you some findings as we go that for women who were randomized to the CCR to get this community-based outreach, they actually perceived the services that they received as significantly more helpful than women in the treatment as usual, the referral condition. So I think that speaks to, I don't think you find services helpful if you don't feel comfortable engaging with providers. So I think that speaks to a level of comfort that women had in connecting with these community-based groups. But I'll try to touch on that question and similar themes as I walk through more of the details of the how, what, when we did in the research part. Sound good to move on?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, great. Well, I always start describing the research by acknowledging that research doesn't happen in a vacuum. It always takes a village. And so the work that I'm about to describe to you involved a host of graduate students who were tireless interviewers on the project, collaborators, particularly Joanne Belknap at the University of Colorado Boulder, as well as Angela Gover, Susan Buckingham, and Jennifer Labus. We also had the work I described couldn't have happened with without the triage partners from the DA's office, city attorney's office, the police department, the Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, Safe House Denver, Project Safeguard, Amend, and the steering committee. The work I'm going to describe was also funded by the National Institute of Justice as well as the University of Denver. In any presentation I do based on this work, I'm supposed to note to you that the opinions, findings, and conclusions or recommendations are those of me and not necessarily the Department of Justice. I also want to acknowledge, as you'll hear, we talked to 236 women about their experiences of domestic violence, of services that they received, and followed up with them over a year after that original incident. And so none of this work would have happened without their willingness to share their voices with us. So what did we do to try to assess the impact of triage? Let me start with who we talked with. We advertised this study as the Women's Health Study, and we worked with the police department in order to reach out to and recruit women who had experienced intimate partner abuse that was reported to law enforcement if their cases involved non-sexual IPA. The reason for that was non-sexual incidences of domestic violence are publicly accessible in Colorado, which allowed us to access police reports. If the domestic violence involved sexual assault, they were not publicly accessible. So I'm focusing on incidences that were reported to law enforcement as not involving sexual assault. The incident had to involve a heterosexual couple with a female victim, and both the victim and offender had to be adults, and there couldn't have been a cross arrest. So we're talking about heterosexual cases where the male was arrested for the domestic violence. The study, we elected to focus on women in the study given that that reflects the majority of cases that are reported to law enforcement and that triage was working on. And so with limited resources, we focused on women's experiences of domestic violence. We ended up interviewing 236 women within about a month of the incident that was reported to law enforcement. And one of the things that's important to know about the women who we ended up talking with is that they came from areas all over the city and county of Denver. In fact, we were able to work with the Denver Police Department in order to look at spatial data of where incidences of domestic violence were reported in Denver throughout our study period. And then we were able to overlay and look at where women who we interviewed actually lived. And because neighborhoods and different places that in which women may reside can reflect things about demographics, we were encouraged that the women we interviewed appeared representative of the cases that occurred in Denver. So one of the things you always want to worry about in research is, did we end up talking to a unique group of women who don't really reflect all of the women who experienced domestic violence that's reported to law enforcement in Denver? The ways that we've looked at the data, we're encouraged that we think we have a pretty representative sample. You won't be surprised to find out that that sample was terrifically diverse. So women ranged in age from 18 to 63. They were an average age of about 33. They were diverse with regard to racial and ethnic background. About 72% of women identified with one or more ethnic or racial minority groups, the largest of those being women identifying as Black or African American or as Latina, with about 30% of women identifying as Black or African American and about nearly 40% identifying as Latina. Participants were also diverse with regard to marital status. About half reported ever having been married. And they described their current relationship statuses as everything imaginable, from about 10% married, a number divorced, separated, widowed, about 40% single and never married. They also were diverse with regard to education, with a couple of participants having as little education as first through eighth grade. The majority had some high school or high school, about 53% of participants, and the rest some college or beyond. in terms of what we did, we tried to piggyback the research onto what was happening at Triage already. So as you've heard from Doralee and Margaret, essentially a report at the time that we were doing the study would come into law enforcement, and someone on the system side, usually an advocate from law enforcement, but sometimes from the city or district attorney's office, would attempt to contact the victim to find out what sort of service needs she had. What would happen next is the incident report, as well as the information from that contact with the system-based advocate, would go to this interdisciplinary triage review. Before women were randomized, which essentially means a fancy way of saying we arranged a proverbial flip of the coin to figure out if they were to get community-based outreach or treatment as usual in the system, the triage review team did their own safety review, and they came up with a set of parameters for which they would say that women were excluded from the potential of being in the research project because there were such grave safety risks that the team wanted to be sure that the woman got outreach. This was a minority of cases, but it gave the review team a way to opt out of the research protocol and preserve the randomization for as many cases as possible. So following that discussion about safety, the coordinator of the triage review team would reveal to the team whether that woman had been randomized to outreach or referral. If she was randomized to outreach, then the triage team would decide who's the best lead agency in this case. If something in the incident report or in the information that the system-based advocate collected suggested that she needed help with legal advocacy, for example, then the lead agency might be Project Safeguard, which was the agency working on legal issues. And that the advocate from that community, whichever community-based agency was at the lead, committed to making outreach to the woman as soon as possible after the review team meeting. For women who were randomized to the treatment as usual condition, they would get referrals maybe from the system-based advocates, for example, and this would be things like, sounds like you might need help with counseling, why don't you try calling Safe House Denver? So, Doralee or Margaret, would you add anything to my description of what happened on your side during the research procedures?
No, I think that sounds great.
Okay.
You know, Anne, I just for the listening audience, I know we discussed this before, but all of the community-based agencies were advocacy programs, right? Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah.
So of the choices that you had about who would contact the victim, they were all advocacy programs.
Yes.
I think, yes, yeah, this is Doralee, sorry, it's fair to say that, yeah.
Okay, all right.
But again, that was totally decided by the victim. I mean, the whoever made the first point of contact would say, it sounds to me like you might be interested in a protection order,
right.
A civil protection order. It sounds to me like you might want counseling for your children.
Mm-hmm.
So most of that desire or choice was made by the victim.
And so if let's say you're in a program that doesn't have those distinctions between advocacy programs, let's say you're in a program where all of those services are provided by one program, obviously it would be this research would more or less measure the impact of community-based outreach coming from that one program, and can you extrapolate that way? Am I making sense, or...
That's a question for Anne, I think.
The big difference in terms of the how service delivery happened is, you know, kind of the treatment as usual was the approach many of us have taken always is talk to somebody, kind of assess what their needs are and say, okay, so here's some phone calls.
Right.
Call them, good luck reaching them.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry you're in crisis, but let me give you my referral list with 15 agencies to try and call.
Right.
The difference was really trying to help close that gap and make sure that connect actually happened when, again, as Doralee said, that's what the victim really was wanting.
And then,
making sure that the victim actually got a phone call from an advocate saying, I understand that the police were out last night and that you might be feeling pretty overwhelmed. And let me talk to you about some services that might be helpful to you, or tell me what's going on and what you think you might need.
Right.
And making that connect happen a little easier instead of a victim having to call agencies, perhaps leave messages. So I think it's not so much the number of different agencies or programs you have as much as it is how that process happens.
Right, and that to me was the most significant piece too, was that it wasn't waiting for the victim to call, it was making the initial call to her.
Exactly. I mean, we all know how overwhelming it is to meet with a victim or talk with a victim on the phone and say, okay, here's 13 phone numbers, good luck.
Yeah,
you know, that's just ridiculous.
Right, and they don't know who they are, and there's all kinds of reasons why they wouldn't necessarily follow up on that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, so very good. So what'd you find?
Okay, well, this is Anne again. I'll jump back in with the research piece. So what I just described to you of women getting randomized to receive this community-based outreach or referrals, treatment as usual in the system, that was the elegant design that we proposed in the original grant proposal, and then life got more complicated because it turned out that a few steps back when the system-based advocate tried reaching victims, they didn't always answer the phone, and sometimes when they answered the phone, they said, I don't want anything to do with anybody, please leave me alone. We still sent them an invitation to be part of the research because the research was entirely separate from what was happening in the criminal justice case or in the triage review. So we also have information that I'll describe to you from women who were never reached by someone in the system, but we reached them for the research, or who declined contact with folks in the system but were willing to talk with us. So we actually ended up with four groups of women in the end. Two of them were randomly assigned in this gold standard, rigorous evaluation of the impact of triage, the outreach versus referral, and then two groups of women were just what happens in the real world of practice. Some women were never reached by the system-based advocate, and some declined contact. So what we did on the research side was tried to reach out to women as quickly as possible. We interviewed them within about 26 days of the incident, and then we invited them back for follow-up interviews 6 months later, which I'll refer to as time two, and then 1 year later, which I'll refer to as time three. So we talked with women three times over a year. Importantly, we had 80% or better retention at the follow-up interviews, so we were able to keep in contact with women and hear how their lives and cases continued to progress. When women came in for the research, they were met by a graduate-level female interviewer or by myself. The interviewers were one-to-one. We went through a very thorough consent process where we explained victims' rights as participants should they decide to consent and participate in the study. We also made very clear that we didn't work for the police department or lawyers or community-based agencies, that we were operating separate from those groups, which I think helped with women feeling comfortable sharing with us all of their perceptions and knowing that it wouldn't have an impact on services or their cases or anything along those lines.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that you referred to what you were doing as a health study, right? You didn't say, we're following up with you, but, you know, in your letter you didn't say, we're following up with you because you were identified by the Denver Police Department as being a victim in a domestic. You just said
correct.
You wanted to do a study on their health, right?
Yeah, thanks for making that point, Rose. All of the recruitment materials for the study said women's health study. Our phone scripts talked about the women's health study. Our concern was that we weren't sending anything or saying anything, sending anything to women's homes or saying anything on the phone that could be overheard by an offender that referred to domestic violence, because we didn't want to increase safety risk in terms of offenders being upset that a woman might talk about or be asked about her experiences of domestic violence. We did, though, when women showed up for that first interview, as part of that thorough consent process, we said, you know, we talked to you on the phone about a women's health study. Here's how we got your name. We told them that we had accessed the police report, and the study focuses on domestic violence. Of 237 women that we initially talked with and explained that the study really was going to focus on domestic violence, only one woman declined to participate. So women were still willing to participate.
Dorley, I think that's fabulous. I think that really does speak to Anne's expertise and all the work that you've done.
Right.
Also, I think it speaks to women's willingness and desire to tell their stories too.
Yeah.
which researchers have been at times a little slow to catch up on in terms of thinking there's a lot of risk in doing this kind of research, that victims may not want to be asked about such things.
Well, and it goes to me, this is Rose, it goes to me also as well. Sometimes advocacy programs are reluctant to contact victims because they say they don't want to talk to us, but it's that they don't know what they're going to be talked to about. And once they're oriented to the fact that this is about their health in this case, and it's confidential and it's not going to harm them, it makes a big difference too.
Correct. And the concern you reiterated, Rose, that women may not want folks contacting them. The triage steering committee asked us at some point, can you just ask women if it's okay for advocates to make cold calls to women? And so in our, I forget if it was our time two or time three interview, we said, what do you think about, an advocate from a community-based agency calling you out of the blue after a domestic violence incident? The overwhelming majority of women said that that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
That a call would be appreciated. Where women said, I'm not sure whether I think it's a good idea or a bad idea, I'm kind of ambivalent. Interestingly, for a lot of those women, the reason they gave was because they thought the call wasn't really important to them, that domestic violence was a problem affecting somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very small minority of women, only a handful, who said, no way, don't call. So the overwhelming feedback we got from women is that, done well, it's okay for advocates to make cold calls to victims.
Very good. It's nice to have that confirmation, huh?
Yeah. At the end of each of our interviews, we also asked women to fill out a measure about what it was like to be in the study, and we looked at the relative benefits and costs that she perceived of talking about her domestic violence over time. And I'll just briefly note that women overwhelmingly found the experience to be positive relative to any perceived costs, the costs, things like experiencing negative emotions. So again, more evidence that talking about these about domestic violence and experiences and service needs and so forth, done with respect and done well, can really be done within a stable and positive benefit-to-cost ratio. So what did we find? Now, let me talk to you first about the criminal justice findings. And as I mentioned a little while ago, we were able to retain about 80% of women for the follow-up interviews. It's important for you to know that who we talked to at those follow-up interviews was not related to outreach status. So it's not that we lost women in one particular group over another, nor was retention related to most other factors of interest, which is important because if I tell you this triage thing worked really well, but it turns out that the most complicated cases dropped out of the interviews, then that would be a big potential Achilles heel in the research.
Mm-hmm.
We did tend to lose women who were of lower SES at time three, and women who were living with the offender at time one were less likely to come back for follow-up interviews later. So I'll just keep those things in mind, and I'll come back to them as we go.
Let me just repeat that. So if they were living with the offender on the first contact,
mm-hmm.
they were less likely to come back for time two, did you say?
Correct.
Six months later?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. And did that mean they didn't come back at the third time a year later, or did you just not follow up if they didn't come to time two?
If people didn't come to time two, we persevered and we still tried to invite them to time three. So we did talk to some women at time three who weren't there at time two.
Okay.
Though, if women were living with the offender, they were less likely than their peers to come to either the time two or the time three interview.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Women were across the groups, referral, outreach, didn't ever talk to the system advocate or didn't want to talk to the system advocate. They were generally comparable on everything we looked at baseline, at their dependence on the offender, the number of initial charges, the amount of IPA they'd experienced in the previous 6 months, their socioeconomic status. So it looked like that randomization worked, that we had relatively equivalent groups to start out with. When we looked at the likelihood of women being engaged in the prosecution process, we asked them at each interview, what, if anything, did the prosecuting attorney's office ask you to do, and then how much of that stuff did you actually do? And we found that women in both the outreach and referral conditions, so these were women who had that initial contact with a system-based advocate and went through the triage, their cases went through the triage review, that they were more likely to report that they'd done at least some of the things the prosecuting attorney's office asked than women who from the start said, I don't want to be involved, or didn't pick up the phone when the system-based advocate called. So there was some suggestion that even the experience of that initial positive outreach, an outreach positively received from the system-based advocate, was linked with better engagement with prosecution. We looked at who gets asked to go to court, and 135 of 233 of the women in the study reported that they'd been asked to go to court at some point during the study. And whether or not they were reached by that system-based advocate early on predicted whether or not they were asked to go. So women in the outreach and referral groups were more likely to be asked to go to court than the women in those other two groups who declined or were never contacted by the system-based advocate. I mention that because, again, this seems to speak to either system or community-based outreach early in the process, seems connected to whether women are engaged in the criminal justice process and invited to be part of that process.
Yeah, could you clarify that? So you're saying that they were asked to go, meaning that if what went into that ask? I mean, how was it decided?
This is Margaret, if I can jump in here.
Part of that
was really, again, from a research perspective, trying to operationalize that whole concept of victim cooperation or victim participation in the criminal justice system. I mean, that's such a nebulous term and often gets kind of this judgmental view on it. But it really was trying to help define for research purposes, what does that look like when in terms of how do we operationalize victim participation? And we really looked at things like is a victim returning phone calls from the criminal justice agency? Has she expressed a willingness to come to court if need be? Now, in some cases get resolved without a victim ever needing to come to court. But really trying to help define some of those things, does that help describe, Anne, kind of what we talked about?
Well, and so for me, what you're suggesting is if it's determined early on that you're not a good candidate for quote unquote cooperating, then you may not be asked.
Well, I think it is kind of one of those circular things that comes up at times. I think if it's a situation where a victim isn't returning phone calls, or we're not able, or she has her phone disconnected, or for whatever reason we're not able to contact her, that may shift what decisions get made about the case prosecution and whether or not it's going to be a case that's likely to go to trial or not, some of those kind of issues.
Okay, good. So it does speak to the victim engagement then, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And from a research perspective, we asked women, were you asked to go to court? So these are their perceptions about whether they were asked for could have meant somebody mentioned to them, we'd like you to be in court, or it's other folks, when we've presented this work, have asked, does that mean the victim was subpoenaed? That being asked to go to court doesn't necessarily mean that. So women talked about a range of things in terms of being asked to go to court, such as a system-based advocate telling them the courtroom and stuff that where hearings were happening and saying you can come and observe, so observation of things, versus all the way through we'd like you to testify kind of invitations to go to court.
So I'm going to interject and remind people to do press 1 on your dial if you want to get in on this. I've got another question that comes up for me, and that is, were the women, you know, this whole piece about where they asked to go to court and the engagement level, that sort of thing, were the women in ongoing contact with these community-based advocates, or Was it just the one contact, or how did that work?
It really varied. Women were very diverse with regard to how much they were using community-based services and how much they were in touch with either community-based or system-based advocates. So it varied quite a bit.
Okay.
This story, yeah. It was kind of all over the place from what I recall, definitely.
Did you correlate any of that, like numbers of contacts versus outcomes?
We didn't look at number of contacts because that was extremely messy in terms of trying to figure out what counted as a contact and who was it really from, because women didn't always know where advocates were positioned within which agencies. Yeah, so I can't tell you that. I can tell you the services that women received in that outreach condition they perceived as more helpful. So we think outreach did get women connected with the right resources faster or more effectively than in the referral condition.
Very good. Okay.
But now, do you want to hear the exciting thing?
Yes.
Is when we looked at who went to court. So for 131 women that were asked to go to court, 91 said they went and 40 said they didn't go. And being in that community-based outreach condition actually meant that women were significantly more likely to go to court than women in the referral group, and also women who were never reached early on, never reached by a system-based advocate early on. So in this outcome of who actually ends up going to court, we see emerge one of the first important findings about this sort of CCR, that being randomized to that group and getting that community-based outreach call was linked with a greater likelihood of having gone to court. So that's really quite important.
Yeah.
We looked at all sorts of potential logistical barriers to getting to court. We literally modeled where women lived and if they took the bus, how much of a pain in the neck that would be. So we looked at a host of potential barriers. And the effect of outreach remained consistent, and we didn't clearly find barriers such as how many bus stops, how many bus transfers away and things like that getting to court was. Though we did find that women's perceptions, their beliefs at the first interview of how difficult it would be to get to court did predict whether or not they went to court. So if women early on anticipated more problems getting to court, they were less likely to go. And so that may suggest that no matter where your agency is located, having advocates who can talk with women about logistical barriers, like what they perceive to be the problems of getting to court or transportation issues, can be useful. We looked at overall case disposition we had case disposition at the end of the year for 231 out of the 236 cases. On the surface, it looked like for the majority of cases, hovering around 60%, they ended with a verdict being entered. For about 30% of cases, they ended up being dismissed, and for somewhere around 10% of cases, charges were refused. What we found that was really quite striking, so remember that issue I raised earlier about women living with the offender? Those were women who were less engaged with the research process at time two and time three, but we did have information about case disposition from the DAs and the city attorney's offices. We found that those women, when women were living with the offender early on, outreach seemed to have a very pronounced positive impact on case outcomes. So for women living with the offenders, if they were in that outreach condition, 100% of those cases ended in a guilty verdict. Not being a lawyer and only being a researcher, it seems to me that keeping those women engaged in the research process, I would anticipate that similar struggles would happen in prosecuting cases where a woman is still economically tied to her offender and living with the offender, that those must be pretty tough cases to prosecute. And so we see this really striking impact there of outreach with 100% of those cases resulting in a guilty verdict, relative to only about 35% of the cases in the treatment as usual condition resulting in a guilty verdict.
Wow, that seems pretty That's significant. I mean, it's a, I don't know, significance, a research term, but it's an important finding, I would say. And Margaret, maybe you can weigh in. Is there something else going on here? Was there criminal no contact? I mean, how was it that the women, in the cases where they were living together, there was a conviction?
Well, and that has been an incredibly interesting finding, and one that we've really tried to make sure we get out in front of our prosecutors and our advocates here to really help look at that ability to connect is critically important, and that we don't make wrong assumptions about cases we see where the victim is still somewhat engaged in the relationship.
Right.
Although you are correct, the way the system works, there is a mandatory protection order put in effect at the time of the arrest and is typically in place throughout the duration of the case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we could speculate on a couple of things. One is that if perhaps there still is some contact going on with that couple throughout the duration of the case, if they are also connected to services and having advocacy and support, that is hopefully making a positive impact.
Right.
The other way to look at it, too, is that perhaps with the protection order in place, even though she was with the offender engaged in that relationship at the time of the offense, sometimes I see, again, this is more anecdotal, but where that protection order kind of gives a victim some breathing room to start reevaluating what's going on and connect with services and make some decisions based on that.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me too is, you know, that maybe she's getting information about he's going to maybe be court ordered into some program to
right.
a batterer's offender program, so that might help. But let me just clarify, Anne, and then I don't want to hold you up anymore on proceeding with this, but. Where the woman was living with the offender and there was outreach, that resulted in 100% convictions. It didn't result in convictions where it was a referral. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. So
yeah,
outreach clearly beat treatment as usual in the system in this case where, I guess maybe I should frame it as offenders still living with victims rather
right.
than making it sound as if it's...
Yes,
her choice that she's because the protection orders are again, of course, entered against him. So.
Right, and then so, and what was it in the referral?
It was about 35%.
Oh yes, that's really a big difference. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
And building on what Margaret said about something about outreach or contact with advocates providing some room to reevaluate relationships, another of our most striking finding was that women who were randomized to the outreach condition reported significantly higher what we call stage of change scores a year later than women in the referral condition. Stage of change refers to how women are thinking about their relationships, with higher scores meaning that they've already done or are in the process of doing things to leave the abusive relationship. So outreach was linked with women being more likely to have already done or be in the process of doing something to leave the relationship relative to treatment as usual in the system. And that finding helps me bridge to sharing with you a few things about the impact of this CCR on women's well-being. We looked at a range of distress kinds of symptoms, PTSD symptoms, depression symptoms, as well as women's feelings of fear related to the domestic violence. Interestingly, we found that for women who declined that initial contact with the system-based advocates or didn't answer their phones way back at the start, but who did talk with us, they reported lower symptoms and lower distress relative to women in the outreach and referral conditions. So for some women who don't engage early on, it may be that they're not experiencing distress. And for women who are experiencing higher levels of distress, the inclination to engage early on may be greater. What we saw was, again, another really pronounced effect of outreach, such that for most women from time one to time two, we saw overall declines in PTSD, depression, and fear symptoms, sort of what you'd expect, that over time women are feeling better. But at time three, women who were in that outreach condition held on to those gains, while women in the treatment as usual condition started showing worse symptoms. So they started showing a return to increases in PTSD, depression, and fear. So this is very striking that early community coordinated response could have an impact a year later on women's psychological experiences of distress. We had initially thought that or hoped that this kind of CCR would have an impact on re-victimization, that something about doing coordinated outreach to victims would improve victim safety. In hindsight, it seemed like we were expecting focusing on the victim to change offender behavior. And in hindsight, that didn't seem like the best idea in the world. And the data actually support that. Across groups, revictimization was all too common. Nearly 80% of women reported at least one new incident of psychological aggression. 30% reported an additional incident of physical aggression with the offender. And about 30% reported an additional incident of sexual aggression. So it wasn't the case that outreach was linked with better victim safety. It was more the case that revictimization was all too common in women's lives. We did see in terms of service use that women in either the outreach or the referral condition were more likely to be accessing services than the women in the other two groups over time. But as I've mentioned a couple of times, the quality of that service was better for women in the outreach condition. And as I've mentioned, we suspect that that's due to the triage process resulting in a better fit for services early on. So those are some of the highlights from the research piece of what we've been talking about is the best examples of the impact that outreach has. We've certainly done a host of other data analyses. We've tried to be responsive to questions that the Triage Steering Committee has had that might influence their policy and practice. So there's a lot more on this project. But since we're almost at 2:00, I will sort of open things or turn it back to Rose to perhaps open things up for broader discussion about implications or answer questions.
Well, yeah, thank you, Anne. And again, if you have a question, press 1 and you'll get into the queue. Or if you're hesitant to do that, you can email liz@praxisinternational.org. It'd be really interesting to hear what people have to say. And it's a lot of information to go through quickly, and I highly encourage everybody to look at the research and pour over it. There's a lot in there that can be used for CCRs. And, in fact, I was going to ask Margaret to discuss with us any of the implications that she saw relative to, prosecution or other aspects of the criminal court process that you wanted to highlight in terms of implications for CCR?
Well, I think there have been numerous implications, and as you've noted, the research that Anne did is just chock full of great nuggets of information, and we've had her come back to our team meetings repeatedly to kind of give us new insights or to ask additional questions about, well, what do you think about this or how would it impact that? And it's been just great. Specific implications, certainly it has, I think, made everybody around the table and been good, a good foundation to keep bringing that information back to, like, the new prosecutors in our office and remind folks when they're working with cases. And having everybody have a little broader understanding and view of each other's roles,
mm-hmm.
and recognizing that it really does take everybody with combining intervention really to make a more global impact, that it isn't just a matter of the criminal justice system impact or just a matter of getting this victim in counseling, that it really does take all of the components, understanding their roles and their piece in that intervention. And I think the work that Triage has done has really helped people think more globally about what issues they may be hearing from a victim. I think it has definitely helped us look more closely, and everybody, no matter what their role is, look more closely at risk and risk assessment and safety issues.
Mm-hmm. If I can jump in here, this is
sure.
like one of the other things that I think has just gone a long way as far as the triage process is, the bonding process, which is, sounds a little ridiculous, but we've worked with many of the same folks now for 5 years, you know, and when this first started, the idea from the detectives in the domestic violence unit of being in the same room with the tree huggers or the man haters was, you know, appalling. But at this point in time, I feel so comfortable in picking up the phone and calling Detective Simpson and say, this is what's going on. And the other realization is the limitations of confidentiality, I think, has been a big thing. I remember him trying to contact a victim in one of the outlying shelters, and he calls me and he said, what's the address of blah, blah, blah? And I said, I can't tell you that. What do you mean? I'm the police. Well, once we have basically established that trust and respect for each other and honoring our limitations, it's just gone a long way as far as that's concerned. So I think that's really an important piece
mm-hmm.
as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to say, too, and Anne didn't mention this, but there was women of color were 3 times more likely to report positive outcomes psychologically, right? And was it across court outcomes as well? Anne, can you say something to that?
The women who got the outreach were significantly more likely to have better mental health outcomes, yes.
But wasn't it for women of color that...
I'm sorry. Yeah. We did look at potential moderators. So were there demographic factors, for example, that augmented or diminished the impact of the outreach? And when we looked at particularly the criminal justice variables, outreach seemed especially important for ethnic minority women. So the things such as coming to court, ethnic minority women who received outreach were significantly more likely than ethnic minority women in the other groups to go to court. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, Ruth.
Oh, yeah, very good. The other thing for me, too, Dora Lee, you mentioned something about the bonding process.
I don't want to get too warm and fuzzy here,
yeah.
But yes.
But, I mean, in some ways, it elevated the status of what you as advocacy programs do, because it said, we make a difference, right?
Exactly. And I think the respect, especially of the law enforcement folks that are at the table of the community-based organizations, has just grown by leaps and bounds. You know, they'll call advocates at Safe House or Safeguard or whatever and discuss all kinds of things. And knowing that they can't necessarily confirm or deny that they've had contact with the victim, but a lot of times the conversations are just sort of generic. But the mutual respect that I think I've seen at the table and that has grown is just amazing.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me listening to this as somebody who has worked forever in this field is just the whole idea in that the victims were valued for their input, and this is the research was a really good example of being victim-centered and using what you know from them to evaluate what you do, and you know that must have had a. I suppose you can't. There's no way of measuring the impact of, or is there a way of measuring the impact of actually getting back with these women 3 times a year and saying, tell us some more about your life and how you feel and all that? Could you mediate for that influence?
Well, luckily, everyone in the study got that influence.
Oh, yes.
So
good.
It's,
mm-hmm.
it's, we are sure that the effect of outreach isn't just because we took care in how we did the interviews, because all women, we took care. Our interviewers were actually blind. They didn't know which condition women were assigned to, so that we were sure we weren't accidentally cheating just because we liked the triage team and you know, hearing what women said in a particular way because we knew they were in the outreach condition. So interviewers did not know what condition women were in.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Thanks for that clarification. Yeah, that makes
Although this is Margaret, I will speak to the positive impact that just the participation in the study can have on on some victims. I was doing some first contact on the cases we had here once they got filed, and I ended up talking with this woman who at some point in the conversation started telling me about, well, I talked to those women, you know, and I wasn't really sure who she was referring to. And finally she said, well, you know, those research women. And she kind of went on about how helpful it was to share her experience and be able to really, and she talked about leaving that, and she was actually leaving the state for a couple of weeks following the incident and had this long period of time in the car to kind of reflect and think about all the questions and the discussion, and really came to some very different conclusions about the relationship. But she just had such positive things to say about, they listened to me, they were interested in my experience, it made me realize all these things about how I've let things slip away from my life that were important to me because of this relationship. And I, that has really just stayed with me in terms of the pot, because I think for those of us, when we partnered with Anne, even though we'd gone through all kinds of work to talk about safety issues and what does this mean and what develop the questions, it was really impressive to me how what a positive experience it was for that victim, and I think for lots of others. I just happened to hear from this one, their participation in the study was.
Very good, good. Doralee, any implications for what you do?
I just think it's important, again, to change the way we do business. And even though with the research that Anne has generated and the brilliant work that she's done, there still seems to be a slight level of reticence sometimes from advocates in the community-based organizations. I can't call this victim just out of the blue. Well, research shows that you can. You know, I think that's just huge as far as just changing the way we do business with the different organizations. And it's also different in that because some of the agencies I do outreach with aren't at the triage table, they don't understand the process, and it takes a while to sort of educate them about that. But once they've had some contact with victims and done those cold calls, it's night and day.
Very good. Yes, I think, and I'm always adding my voice to that particular chorus, is that it's over and over it's been proven anecdotally and now with this that it's, you know, I think Doralee, and I don't know how long you've been in this, I think
too long.
And there was an early philosophical position that we don't contact victims.
It's invasive, it's their business,
empowerment, or all kinds of reasons. But the time is now, I think, to reevaluate your own system and say, look, okay, this makes a difference in their lives. And I thought it was significant that you also excluded from the research those women where you knew after you did some risk assessment that they were at greater risk. So that provided the absolute to go ahead and contact those victims without and not have them just referred. So you're definitely a proponent for the importance of getting to victims.
Absolutely.
And I think this is Anne again. I think the research, women's, what they said about the research, either the anecdotal example Margaret shared or the data we collected about the benefits they perceived, it's a parallel example of cold calling victims and asking them their opinions on things. And, you know, as part of our consent procedures, as you probably do in practice, we explained you're in the driver's seat. I'm going to ask you lots of questions, but your job is to answer the ones you want to answer
exactly,
and not the rest. So I think there are ways to empower women to share what they want to of their stories and ask for what they need and not share what they don't want to, in how we do research and in how we do this kind of intervention.
And, giving them power to basically make those decisions, putting them in the driver's seat, because they've been so disempowered for so long, that's just kind of a new way of looking at things.
Well, and it's not like the decision, you know, whether they're going to dial the number is going to be the fact that makes them empowered versus somebody calling them up and they answer the phone. I mean,
exactly.
There's so many other ways they're empowered by somebody contacting them and saying, here's all the things that are going to happen.
Yep.
Here's the information that's going to make a difference in your life. So that's the approach. And I think, you know, relative to programs on the call, too, be sure, we've got 5 minutes left if you have a question to ask, to press 1. But it doesn't require, you're Denver, you've got multiple agencies, lots of people at the table, been doing it for a long time. I think even if you were to start, if you're starting cold in a community that's very small and all you are is an advocacy program, that's a good place to start, is by
exactly.
contacting victims. If you got nothing else in place, would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree.
Absolutely.
When we first started, that parts of this can be replicated pretty much in any community, especially when you're starting to build the trust and honoring everybody's limitations and what the expertise they can bring to the table. That's so important.
The other thing, too, I remember that in reading the research was you talked about the importance of being more victim-centered, that you felt that CCRs generally spent a lot of time, even though their goal is to enhance victim safety, that a lot of the focus is on increasing offender accountability victims, when you don't outreach, they get kind of left by the wayside. So this is a way of enhancing that. Would you say
some more
about
that? You can't have one without the other.
What's that?
You can't have one without the other, I don't think.
Okay, so this is a way then of putting some focus there, huh?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
One thing that comes to mind as we're talking, too, about how folks may implement parts of this in their own communities, Meg Garvin from the National Crime Victim Law Institute did a commentary on the criminal justice, an article describing these criminal justice findings. And in that, I think she made the really important point that not only was outreach linked with some positive things, more importantly, it wasn't linked with bad things. Her experience is that sometimes from the prosecution side, people say, you know, stay away from the victim in the case. If other people are getting involved with the victim, things are going to go awry or it's going to hurt the case in some way, that there's a knee-jerk reaction. There can be, in some communities, a knee-jerk reaction. And so I think she made the really important point in a lovely commentary that it's great that outreach was linked with some positive things, and then even better in terms of talking with and building relationships with your own prosecuting attorney's offices. Being victim-centered did not get in the way of prosecuting these cases.
Right. Very good. Right. And living with the victim, I mean, living with your perpetrator didn't impact Nick. I mean, it was a positive in terms of convictions.
Well, outreach is influence in those cases, yes.
Yes, yes. Okay, it looks like we've got 2 minutes left. Any final comments from you? We'll start with you, Anne. Anything to say? Let me preface it by saying that the article you just mentioned, Liz will get a hold of you to get that resource, and then also your actual research studies will be available, I believe, through Liz, right? Is that Liz, right, Liz? You tell people
that's right, yes. And so anyone interested in PDF copies of the research articles that we've been discussing should feel free to send an email to liz@praxisinternational.org, and I'll be happy to forward those on to you. And I wondered, too, about contact information from Anne, Margaret, and Dora Lee. If people are interested in contacting you, are you open to that?
Oh, absolutely. I was going to offer my email address, as a matter of fact.
Okay, great. So perhaps as you are just, you know, in the last moment or two, making your closing comments, if you want to just provide that information, and then people can also contact me if they don't happen to have that.
Sure.
Okay. This is Anne, and I appreciate your time. I think I use the bulk of the time, so I will just leave things with what I said, and I would welcome contact from folks, and also at my research team's website, which is mysite.du.edu/TildeADEPRINC. I'll send that to Liz since it's a bit of a mouthful. At that website, you can find other full-text articles coming from this triage project, as well as other of our victim-centered projects.
Okay, thank you, Anne.
This is Margaret, and my email is mxa@denverda.org, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions. And the only final piece I just kind of wanted to point out is that the outreach and the triage team looks at cases regardless of whether or not they're actually filed and prosecuted. So we're reaching a pretty broad audience, which, again, we thought was really important. We know that for a variety of reasons, cases may not go forward to be prosecuted, but that doesn't mean that there's still not concerns and issues and problems that services can help address for victims.
Thank you, Margaret. Dorley, you get the final word.
Oh, goody. I love being in the closer. You know, one of the things I have to say is I have to share my appreciation of having access to someone as brilliant and ethical as Anne DePrince is. She's done such a fabulous job as far as concretizing this research and letting us share nationally and sometimes internationally what really does work and demystifying all of those assumptions that we used to have back in the day in the movement. So I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And again, this any part of triage can be replicated, I think, in any community, whether you're rural, urban, combination of the two. And if folks would like information from me or contact me, it's ddvcc@q.com.
Thank you, Dorley. Sure. And thus concludes our talk for this afternoon. And thank you so much, women, for your work and the research you did. I'm just, I don't know, I've never been happier about a piece of research. So thank you for your good work. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, especially to Anne, Dorley, Margaret, and as always, Rose. Just one quick thing on my part. You should have all received an evaluation link in your inbox, so please, please, please. I know evaluations can sometimes be a little bit tedious, but it's so important to our programming. So if you would take 3 minutes and share your thoughts with us, we would appreciate it. And contact me if you are interested in our speaker's contact information or those research articles, of course. So everybody, thanks so much. Our next call will be June 19th, Wednesday the 19th, 3 Strategies of System Change, Networking, Gap Fixing, and Interconnected Accountability. So I hope to talk to you all then.